And you are what you eat, according to this HADSA study, linking diet changes to altered microbiome, Stanford University. And a study examines the effects of stopping psychiatric medications. We've heard you can't stop psychiatric medications. You have an extremely difficult time. Well, a lot of people did, and over 87% of the people were able to go to the next year without relapse and without difficulty. So why are so many people taking psychiatric meds to begin with? And do we need them? Do we have an epidemic of mental illness in the United States? And if so, why are we the only country in the world? Out of 7.7 billion people, our little puny 330 million is the only one suffering from all this brain chemical imbalance? Why aren't we stopping long enough to examine these? We will. From our environmental segment today, we have a new article from Dar Jamal, "Scientists Warn of Biological Annihilation as Warming Reaches Levels Unseen in 115,000 Years. And Dar is a really cautious, even conservative environmental reporter. So if he's talking about biological annihilation, what does that mean? And I'll give you the data on how they're looking at the Amazon over the last 30 years. And the Amazon is the lungs of the planet. It takes an enormous amount of carbon sequestering, meaning it takes carbon out of the air and stores it into the root systems and into the trees and all the flora and fauna. So when we're taking that away, we then have no place to capture that carbon. So there's going to be some devastating effects. Also, climate change has got a new problem. It's not the flooding. It's not the earthquakes. It's not all the other things that we're seeing. According to the Earth Institute at Columbia University, it's driving very fast forest-eating beetles north. Well, that's not good. How bad is it? How about this? How about in the last year, more than 100 million trees have died in California because of the drought and because they're susceptible. It's like a human that eats only junk foods. Their immune system is susceptible. Well, the forests are now the trees susceptible to these beetles. Now, I've been there. I've been in Northern California in the forest. Oregon, Washington State, Wyoming, Montana, Colorado, Idaho, Utah. I've been all these places. And when I was up last in Arizona at the highest points up at Flagstaff where the university is, there are three levels in Arizona. There's Phoenix, which is down low, and then it's very hot. And then you go up a couple hours, and then you get to Sedona, very beautiful community, wonderful, kind of red rocks. You can drive through it in 5 minutes, very small community, about 12,000 people or less now. And then another hour, an hour and a half, you're up at Flagstaff. You're way up. And historically, that's where people had gone to get away from the scorching heat in the summertime. Now, all these forest fires, major forest fires. I was there in the midst of a forest fire. And I was doing my annual spiritual retreat where I go alone someplace and commune with nature. And all around me, trees were burning. And when I'd ask people, what's one of the causes? Well, it's drying out and these beetles are infesting it. So now it's happening on the East Coast, New York State, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island. All these are also susceptible now. So we've got a lot to share today. And also, I didn't have a chance to get to it yesterday. Naomi Klein's Hurricane Harvey didn't come out of the blue. Now it's time to talk about climate change. And so we're going to talk about environmental issues a little longer than normal on today's show. And then after our break, we're going to come back and I'm going to have one of the best physician scientist in America share her concerns about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. She was pro-vaccine. And the more she researched, the more concerned she was. So that's what we have coming at you. So let's begin. We know we should be taking antioxidants every day. There's a school of thought that was around for a long time. In fact, I was very young. I was in my early 20s when I had a chance to meet the natural hygienist. Herbert Shelton was probably the best known of them. But there was a Dr. Walker and Pavli Rola. And these people believed that you could get all the nutrition you need from a good diet. And they were plant-based diets. The trouble was that from my looking at them, they were all rather sickly. They didn't do exercises. They didn't take supplements. They did herbs, and they did food. And a certain part of the diet was raw as well. So when I had a discussion with them, and I went up to a vegan conference upstate, and you wouldn't believe it. You talk about a retreat. Wow. This was my first retreat I'd gone on. I didn't give this. I went as a participant, and they wanted me to do a lecture from a young person's perspective, because everyone else there was in their 60s and 70s and 80s. And it was an old, run-down, abandoned place in the Catskills. It wasn't a resort. It was like a large, white, Victorian house that was needed painting, and everything stunk, and the swimming pool was all grown over. There was vines growing in the swimming pool. But it was a nice group of people, and they sat around and regaled in eating what looked like little mud balls. And, this is our delicacy. This is string beans with walnuts. And I said, looks and tastes like a mud ball to me. But, of course, they were real purists, meaning we're purists. We don't want anything to taste good. Kind of reminds me of macrobiotic restaurants. Here, have this whole grain bread. Am I allowed to chew it? Yeah. It's kind of hard. Will I have any teeth left when I finish? Not sure about that. So they give me this stuff. And, yippity-doo-dye. They just gave me some really exciting oat sauce. Well, they just warmed up some oats with water and poured that over some brown rice like that was supposed to taste like something. I can't tell you how absolutely closed in on the creative level all these macrobiotics were. In any case, the food at least was healthy. Okay. And I'm sure that these string bean mud balls that they were serving made out of some walnuts, and I'm not sure about the hygiene. I think I saw one of the people in the kitchen that you could have grown sprouts from underneath this guy's fingernails because there was so much dirt there. But in his world, I guess it's natural. So I kind of fasted that weekend. And here these people were just all up about food. And I simply asked them a question. Have any of you had your blood test taken for your antioxidant levels? No. Well, then how do you know you're eating enough? And I gave an example, and I would later come back to that example years later. And I said, the neighbor across the road there, if you see, they have a goat farm, goat dairy, and goats are known to produce about 20,000 to 30,000 milligrams of vitamin C per day. So if a goat out here where there are no sprays, no pesticides, no pollutants, no stress, if they're in that little body producing 30,000 milligrams of vitamin C, how much should a human body that, let's say, weighs 160 pounds have to produce if we produce from glucose in their liver as these other creatures do? How much would we need? I don't know. So you think you're getting enough of it from eating an apple or having an orange? And yet they were so into their way and no other way that didn't resonate. I was never invited back from that society. Not sure I would have accepted the invitation. They were pleasant enough, but man, they had the wrong information on their side. It was limited. One piece of a puzzle. Today we know that the science of antioxidants shows that we can use multiple antioxidants each day, and each one does something different, unique. the superstars would be vitamin C, alpha-lipoic acid, ubiquinol or coenzyme Q10, the vitamin E or tocotrienols and tocopherols, but also zinc, which is a great one as well, and selenium. We're just not using them all. But the more antioxidants you take in the body, the more free radicals you trap, the more free radicals you trap, the less damage to your cells, the less damage, the less inflammation, the less aging. It's that simple. So here's the latest study on antioxidants. And this is from Moorfields Eye Hospital in the United Kingdom, published in the British Journal of Ophthalmology. Quote, scientists concluded that supplements with antioxidant nutrients is effective and affordable for individuals with wet, age-related macular degeneration, or what's called wet form of the condition, characterized by the growth of abnormal blood vessels under the retina that can leak and damage the eye's macula, which is responsible for our central vision. So, and they state, quote, vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc, copper, and beta carotene, and xanthine were all effective. So now, with the number one cause of blindness being macular degeneration, you have some solution. Then we have this from Touro University, and as well as University of California in San Francisco. And this is about the diet cuts liver fat by more than 20% in only 9 days. This is from the journal Gastroenterology. It says, in a 9-day experiment, researchers from Touro University and University of California, San Francisco, found that a diet with reduced sugar cut liver fat by more than 20%. And cutting out the sort of sugar commonly found in soft drinks, in fruit juices, and processed foods reversed the buildup of liver fat in children and adolescents, a condition closely tied to diabetes and heart disease. Fatty liver disease in youth has more than doubled in the past 20 years, leading to increased insulin resistance that in turn reduces a person's ability to control blood sugar, which leads to type 2 diabetes. So, get rid of the sugar, and you can help prevent or reverse fatty liver disease. Now, how many Americans, adults, suffer from fatty liver disease? We're looking at probably, I'm guesstimating, around 40 to 50 million. So it's serious, and it can kill you. Then zinc, coming back to that antioxidant again, this is from University of Washington as well as University College London. A formula supplement containing antioxidants plus zinc appears to be cost-effective in slowing progression of macular degeneration. So once again, take zinc. I'm suggesting 15 to 25 milligrams will do the job and help your eyes. That's two studies on that. And from the Australian National University, healthy glucose at your blood sugar level is the key to healthy aging of your brain. Quote, new research has found blood glucose levels, even at the normal range, can have a significant impact on brain atrophy and aging. A Dr. Walsh, lead author of this study, found that blood glucose on the brain is not limited to people with type 2 diabetes. Quote, people without diabetes can still have high enough blood sugar glucose levels to have a negative health outcome. So what this really means is this. Think of all the athletes. Think of all the professional athletes who are sponsoring alcohol or beverages. And alcohol is giving you a lot of calories. And sugar gives you a lot of empty calories. But because you're athletic and because your body is trim, you think, what's the problem? I'm athletic. This reminds me of two athletes who I met. One I knew personally, the other professionally. Fred LaBelle of the New York Runrunner Club would call me and say, Gary, can you have on Bill Rogers, the winner for New York Marathons, or Salazar, whoever the Costello, the great athletes. I'd say, sure. I was helping to sponsor over the radio the New York Road Running Club and the people participating in marathons. And I asked Bill Rogers, I said, Bill, tell us about your diet. And he said, oh, I eat anything. You know, I eat donuts all the time. I remember saying, okay, you are aware that it's the sustainability of being this great athlete that you are that will be determined in no small measure by how good your diet is. He just didn't make that connection. As a result, you never heard much about him as an athlete after he stopped doing marathons. And I've seen this throughout my athletic career. There are athletes. Sid Howard is one good example, one of the greatest mid-runners, 800-meter, the 440 short for him. The mile and two-mile is his specialty. He's one of the greatest three-runners in the world for the last 30 years. Knows Sam Skinner. Thelma Wilson, one of the greatest female runners, athletes in the world. And Thelma ran for the Natural Living Room Running and Walking Club, as did Sam for a long time. We did a lot of races together, a lot of training together, went to national and world games together. And in fact, I never will forget, we went down to do, we enjoyed doing the first marathon. So I did the first Los Angeles Marathon, San Francisco Marathon, Toronto Marathon, Long Island, Marine Corps Marathon. I think I did the third or fourth New York Marathon. From then on, I did like 27 or so of those. The first Jamaica Marathon, the first London Marathon. So I'd look for marathons around the world, and it was just fun getting a group of people and going there and enjoying the environment and the sightseeing for a week and trying the cuisines. And then just to, we weren't racing to win, though that wasn't the case with the LA Marathon and the Jamaica Marathon. We actually raced to win, and did. I won a gold medal in the LA Marathon, and also in the Jamaica Marathon, I won a gold medal. So anyhow, we were going to go do the Jamaica Marathon, and there were four of us who went down there. And at the last moment, we realized that we were both going to be doing the run. And so we said, well, that means one of us is going to lose. And we're about the same quality runners. We expect to do it about the same time. So I said, why don't we just one of us run it, and they have our official race walking division, and one of us race walk it. Okay. But I knew that Sam didn't like the race walking so much. So I said, fine, I'll do the race walking. So the race was late. It was the most torturous, difficult, challenging marathon I've ever done. There was no water after the six-mile mark. They had flooding. In one street, we went down a street, and I remember seeing the rats in the water in front of me, about 5 feet in front of me, and the water was up to the waist, and you're trudging through this water, and they didn't stop the traffic. So all these cars were zigzagging out of the people. They didn't have markers, so you didn't know where you were. At one point, about the 20-mile mark, we went on the wrong path and went down this road for a mile out of our way. In spite of all that, we finished. And both Sam won a gold medal in the running, and I won the gold medal coming in first overall of all the race walkers. And there's a photograph of us. It's up on my website, and you'll see that our legs are white. Now, Sam's African-American. So seeing these streaks of white and also myself, that's salt from our body. That's, we were so dehydrated from not having water for 20 miles, and it was like 100 degrees, and it was 100% humidity, that I don't know how we finished, but we did. And it's one of those remarkable moments. By the way, never had another Jamaica Marathon after that, because a lot of people complained about how poorly it was done. In any case, one of those things you don't forget. You remember wonderful moments. But the reason that Sam Skinner is still competing, the reason that Sid Howard is competing, the reason that so many other athletes over the decades are still competing is because diet was important. Antioxidants were important. They didn't take that for granted. All the other athletes came and went. They had their moment. They were remarkable. They were inspirational. to see, compete with, and their bodies then were burned out. So if you want to know how people like myself and others are still competing 45 or 50 years into a sport and winning and setting records, it's because we make sure we get our antioxidants every day, because that helps trap the free radicals that are produced by exercise, and that means that your cell is going to be alive longer. So don't forget that. So this study pretty much emphasized that, about how you can help overcome conditions with antioxidants. And then there's this final study from Stanford University, You Are What You Eat, has a study links diet changes to altered microbiomes, and it says seasonal changes in gut bacteria make up what we have to go with when it comes to our gut microbiota. But in Tanzania, in what is called the Hadza people, their Hadza, they display an annual seasonal variations, so their gut bacteria changes based upon what they're eating from this study, and they have an extremely high level of good bacteria in their body because they have a healthy diet. And the more healthy food you eat, the healthier diet is. And the healthier the fiber is, the more fiber you have, the healthier your gut is. And so throughout the year, depending upon what food that they eat, the gut changes. Well, in the United States, we're a little different. We eat the same foods every single day. We don't have seasonal variations. Maybe in the fall you might have cranberry sauce, but you're not eating cranberries every day. But what happens when you eat seasonally, which is ideal, locally grown food, which is ideal, and if it's healthy, then that means you're introducing new healthy bacteria that then expand the health of your gut biome. That is the film of bacteria that coats the inside of your intestines and colon. And that means the healthier that bacteria, the healthier your body, and the healthier your brain. So that's all good. I'm Gary Nall. Those are the latest on health and healing. Tomorrow, top healing foods to stop ovarian cancer in its tracks and fix your digestive problems. I'm giving you 8 of the best and worst foods for your digestion. That's on tomorrow's program. Now, before we take our break, I want to go into a few things about our environment. First, this is from Health Institute at Columbia University, and it says, over the next few decades, global warming-related rises in winter temperatures could significantly extend the range of the southern pine beetle, one of the most aggressive tree-eating insects, through much of the northern United States and southern Canada. Says a new study that beetles' range is sharply limited to annual extreme temperatures lows, meaning the colder it is, they don't go up that high. But now, because it's warming up in northern latitudes, they're going up. And so they're saying the next couple decades, I'm going to suggest the next 5 years based upon the newest climate models I'm seeing. So we're going to be seeing a lot of people who think we're okay. We're in a good, safe, environmentally neutral place. We have good cold weather. We have plenty of rain. We're not hit with drought. If you're in Minnesota, up Michigan way, up in North Dakota, Montana, and across the eastern United States in the higher altitudes, that's not true now. Now we're seeing drought in these places. We're seeing fires, massive fires, Nova Scotia, massive fires in Canada. And we're not paying attention. Now the beetles are moving up. So think about that. If you intend to move to a northern latitude or altitude because you think you're going to be safer, won't be true. And this is Dar Jamel. And here's what he has to say on this topic of the scientists' work, warn of a biological annihilation. Talks about, quote, Brazilian Amazon. Less than 30 years ago, the Earth's tropical rainforest held the carbon equivalent of a half of the entire atmosphere. But at atmospheric CO2 has escalated along with the deforestation of so much of the tropics, there is no longer the case. Nevertheless, carbon stored in tropical rainforests is still significant. And then he goes on to talk about why we should pay attention. Let me make it really basic. Every time you have a fast food hamburger, no matter your desire for it and enjoying it, no matter the cost, you're also contributing with many of those burgers to the deforestation of the Amazon. And it's not one cow you're getting your burger from. There are thousands of cows that the meat is all mixed together to make a burger. And now we're not raising that cattle in the United States because much of the grazeland is dead. In fact, if you were to drive through much of the Midwest and the Southwest, you could drive for hundreds of miles and see nothing but dried up fields, wheat fields, corn fields, even cotton fields, which are very tolerant to heat, dry as a bone. So one time they could raise cattle there, not now. So they moved all that operations about 20 years ago down to South America. And there they went into the rainforest and they took giant machines and they tore down those trees, which have a very little root system, almost all at the surface. And when they tore down all those trees and then burned them, that left land then to be planted in the million acres into genetically engineered soybeans or to use that land for grazing. And when there was no longer any grass, they would just tear down more rainforests and plant more grass, and they just kept grazing and destroying, or planting GMOs and destroying it. Now, the president of Brazil, completely corrupt government, completely corrupt country, that has no sensitivity towards its own people and its poor, let alone the environment, has now opened up one of the largest natural preserves in the rainforest for deforestation and mineral exploitation. So just remember, in order to feed the people in India and China and other countries in America, their beef, their chicken, their pork, you have to either raise the animal or raise the food for the animal in places that have 12-month-a-year growing season. That's the Amazon. But now you have drought over the Amazon. You have desertification over the Amazon. You have the Amazon no longer being this vital, phenomenal stream of energy carrying so much life during its 1,000-plus miles. In fact, there are villages that are way back off the Amazon where they used to be right on the Amazon because of the reduction in the size of the Amazon. So the Amazon is dying. The Amazon River is dying. The rainforests are dying. And all because we are not willing to change our patterns of consumption. Government's not willing to tell their people, you shouldn't be eating this. Instead, you should be on a plant-based diet. And as a result, this is all feeding into losing the lungs of the planet. So, just one more reason that we have global warming where we have it. And finally, this comes from a editorial from Naomi Klein. And Naomi wrote this for The Intercept. It's entitled, Hurricane Harvey Didn't Come Out of the Blue. Now is the time to talk about climate change. I'll only read you just a page of it because you can get the understanding where she's going with this. Now is exactly the time to talk about climate change and all the other systematic injustices from racial profiling to economic austerity that turn disasters like Harvey into human catastrophes. Turn on the coverage of the Hurricane Harvey and the Houston flooding, and you hear lots of talk about how unprecedented this kind of rainfall is, how no one saw it coming, and so no one could adequately prepare. What you will hear very little about is why these kinds of unprecedented record-breaking weather events are happening with such regularity that records-breaking has become a meteorological cliché. In other words, you won't hear much, if any, talk about climate change. This, we are told, is out of a desire to not politicize a still-unfolding human tragedy, which is an understandable impulse. But here's the thing. Every time we act as if an unprecedented weather event is hitting us out of the blue as some sort of act of God that no one foresaw, reporters are making a highly political decision. It's a decision to spare feelings and avoid controversy at the expense of telling the truth, however difficult. And because the truth is that these events have long been predicted by climate scientists, warmer oceans throw up more powerful storms, higher sea levels mean those storm surges are going to go into places that never reached there before. Hotter weather leads to extremes of precipitation, long dry periods interrupted by massive snow or rain dumps, rather than the steadier, predictable patterns most of us grew up with. The records being broken year after year, whether for drought, storm surges, wildfires, or just heat, are happening because the planet is markedly warmer than it's been since record-keeping began. Covering events like Harvey, while ignoring those facts, failing to provide a platform to climate scientists who can make them plain, all while never mentioning Donald Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris climate accords, fails in the most basic duty of journalism, to provide important facts and relevant context. It leaves the public with the false impression that these are disasters without root causes, which also means that nothing could have been done to prevent them, and that nothing can be done now to prevent them from getting much worse in the future. It's also worth noting that the coverage of Harvey has been highly political since well before the storm made landfall. There has been endless talk about whether Trump was taking the storm seriously enough, and the endless speculation about whether the hurricane will be his, quote, Katrina moment. And then it goes on from there. And then also, this is from Common Dreams, and it says, extreme storms like Harvey and climate change, this is the new reality. And the challenge is how we address it, how rapidly we're going to transition from fossil fuel to clean energy. And then it goes on to talk about we have to make this now. Okay, my thoughts on this before we take a break. If you've ever been in a hurricane, I have several. If you've ever interviewed the people who are victims of them, like Katrina, I did, Sandy, I did. If you've tried to help people in these moments, you suddenly have this overwhelming sense of incompleteness. You look at the devastation. It is massive. It is biblical. And you hear about once in 500, once in 1,000 years a storm happens. Now you have two of those. One in Houston in the same year, two biblical storms, and two of those in Louisiana in the last 12 months. And yet, nothing was done to prevent this. Now let's pull back far enough. And I discussed this briefly last night in my webinar on plant codes. I spent about 20 minutes talking about what we need to know about the environment. Disasters do not happen all at once to everyone. We don't have an economic collapse where everyone is immediately and equally affected. You won't have a wildfire burning everyone's home, or an earthquake destroying homes, or tidal waves or tsunamis hitting everyone. But they are happening at over 12,000 times a year in the United States, over 120,000 times worldwide, what are called unique weather events, meaning they set records. For example, the most dead fish ever found in a lake this year, the most dead sea mammals out on the Pacific coast this year, the highest sandstorm ever recorded in America, Phoenix, this year. Earlier in the year, the worst flood to hit Louisiana in its history. And now they didn't rebuild from that because people didn't have flood insurance. Now 80% of all the people in the Houston area that are been, they don't have flood insurance, 80%. So here are some lessons if you pull back you can learn. The idea of saying that a person weathered a storm, helped their neighbors, helped others, that is noble, and I respect that. It touches your heart when you see how people put their own life at risk and comfort and safety to go into harm's way to help other people. We're good at that in America. It brings out the best of us. And I respect that. At the other end of that, you see the people most hit are not the people living in the skyscrapers, the multi-million-dollar condominiums. But they're also affected because their generators were in the basement, not the roof. As a result, they can't flush the toilet, get water out of the sink, and they got to climb up and down the steps. And the likelihood is they didn't have a lot of provisions because the first thing that goes in a storm is all the food and water. It's gone. Now, how long people wait until they can have a meal, unless it's an emergency meal at a first aid tent someplace, you have 450,000 people who need help now, and you don't have the help for all of them. The most that can be helped right now is about 30,000 from the last figure I heard. And then no one pays attention after the news cycle finishes another few days, and once the storm's on to Louisiana, everything in Texas is forgotten. It's going to be tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions, dollars in damage. And that doesn't even count for all the billions of stored oil and gasoline in all those refineries that are right there outside of Houston that have flooded. So you're going to have environmental degradation at a level unseen in American history. Because once that floods, there's no way to get it out of the soil. It's going to go right in the soil. And it's going to stay there because you got clay right under the soil, and clay acts as a cap. Nothing permeates it. So you're going to have toxic air, toxic water, toxic soil, massive damage. Now the water is still going, and it's up to the roof in many homes. So forget those homes. You'll never be able to rebuild them. Mold will get inside. Black mold will get inside. They don't have the money to get it. And health authorities will condemn the house, much like they had to do to condemn the homes in Katrina. Why? Why is this happening? Well, it's simple. They destroyed all the barrier islands. They destroyed all the mangrove forests that trap water, absorb water in massive amounts, and reduce the impact of storms and hurricanes when it gets further inland. Then they put up massive developments. The developers have the big dollars. They have the political lobbying clout. And they made sure that all the regulations to allow them to build right up on the ocean, they did. Because everybody wanted a view of the ocean. Understandable. I lived right across from the ocean, down in Ocean Drive in Miami, 15 years. I'm South Beach. And it was beautiful all the time. But I also had a preparation. I was planned. You know, I had storm shutters, yes, but I had everything I needed to get out of there, food supply. I had everything. None of my neighbors did. I remember when a hurricane hit and there was 10 days you couldn't get gasoline. People were even trying to get gasoline by having friends on the other side of the state bring some over to them. But they didn't realize once a storm hits Texas, where a lot of the gasoline and the fuel comes from there. That's where it's refined and shipped. So you're going to see spikes in gasoline prices, probably around $9 to $10 until supply is restored. We don't think about this. Why don't we have regulations that prohibit people from living in harm's way? Politicians, money. And who were hit the worst? The poor were. The poor were hit the worst. And just last week, 1,100 people were killed or missing in Sierra Leone in Africa. Also this week, 1,100 people died in India and from monsoon flooding again. Not the rich, the poor. So income inequality, being the genderfied victims in any community where the rich come in, they want their nice neighborhoods, and you've been living there, but you can't afford to stay. You're forced out, and you have to live where you can. And almost never are there any provisions of what happens if there's disaster. The government could have spent billions of dollars building above-ground disaster centers that would be solar-run with hospital in it, with dining facilities for at least 50,000 people, rooms and a living space for families and single people, and crisis care people there to help people, and backup food storage for at least 6 months. So no matter what disaster, everybody could be helped. Now try to get a nickel out of any of the Texas Republicans, the very people who did not want New Jersey and New Yorkers to get funding to help rebuild from Hurricane Sandy. Ted Cruz was the hypocrite of the year, top of the list. Now look at him out there wanting FEMA to help. Of course FEMA should help. No one should be deprived of what it's required to help them when they're in a disaster. But they're political all the time. They're anti-socialist until they need a handout that is socialism. That's the way it works in the hypocrisy of our dualopolities that we have in this society. So just remember, this is going to happen again and again and again and again and again. It's going to happen to New York City. I absolutely guarantee you New York City is going to get its ass kicked up around its elbows, and these goofball politicians are not going to put the money into informing people that if you live in Lower Manhattan, if you live in the inlet areas, if you live on the ocean, you are not going to be able to be habitable there the first time a Category 4, 5 or storm or higher hits. Remember, Sandy was only Category 1. And if you live on the Jersey Shore, think of the damage that occurred to you and your homes were flooded, your basements were flooded when you had a tropical storm, not even a Category 1. So the new norm is Category 3, 4, and 5s and huge dumping of water. It's now over 50.4 inches of rain. That's more than a year's worth of rain in 1 week. And now it's more. It's probably going to get another 20 inches, more than any flooding has ever happened in American history. And we will not be prepared for the next one. Stop living where nature is going to make an impact. Stop this idea, well, we're going to rebuild. That's just stupid. Because you're saying that common sense and reason and sustainable consciousness are not a part of my metrics for what I'm going to do with this storm. Move to areas that are not affected. I will be giving those information on where those areas are on an upcoming program. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Summer. Well, I was able to secure a dance party venue. I'm signing the contract this afternoon. Once I sign the contract, the dance party will be next Wednesday night. Do not call my office until I have that guaranteed that we're locked in for next Wednesday. And it'll be from 7 to 10 next Wednesday night. It'll be free to you. It's my gift to you. And so tomorrow I will announce the number that you'll call so you'll have specifics, because our person working the front desk today is off today. So nobody would pick up the call. And we're going to play wonderful music. It's going to be a great opportunity for you. If you're a couple, young, old, doesn't matter. I'm going to be there. If you have a book you want me to sign, I'd be happy to do that. I'm going to select the music, and then we're going to get a DJ. If we've got DJs in the office, audience, let us know tomorrow. I'd like for you to hear a medical doctor. I've been promising this for several days. A medical doctor tell us about her journey to find the truth about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. She was 100% pro-vaccine. And this is a board-certified physician with a science background. Here's what she has to say.
The whole issue of vaccine safety has been that we've always been told that vaccines are safe. But we've never really explored the other side. Are vaccines unsafe? Vaccine safety studies are short. They're inconclusive. They don't go on for a long period of time. All the studies are performed on children who are not ill, on no medications, and are by definition healthy. But once a vaccine is approved, it's been given to all children and all adults, even those who have been chronically sick and are on many different types of medications. So we really don't know until that happens what the true clinical trial is around safety. When I first started researching vaccination and looking at the whole concept of vaccine efficacy, because what always comes out is that vaccines are safe and effective, it took me a while to figure out what that word effective really even meant. We as clinicians and doctors and even parents in the lay public, when they hear the word effective, they assume that what that means when the phrase is said, vaccines are safe and effective, meaning that vaccines are safe and they will keep you from getting sick. But digging deeper into the scientific research, what I came to find out was that what effective really means is that a substance is injected into a body and it creates an antibody. And if an antibody response is generated by that shot, then the science says the vaccine is effective. It did what it was supposed to do. The shot created an antibody. There is a leap in assumption then that simply because you have the antibody, it will protect you and keep you from getting sick. And there's a lot of information out there that says that antibodies, we're not really sure what they really mean. Do the antibodies really mean that you are chronically sick? Does it mean you've had an exposure? You've had a certain level of protective antibody and you can still get sick? So the whole word in the scientific literature about effective vaccines means that you create an antibody. But that doesn't necessarily translate from effective into protecting you from getting sick. Recently, we have seen outbreaks of mumps and pertussis in the last couple of years. And in the mumps outbreak that happened in Iowa about 2 or 3 years ago, we found that 67% of the children who contracted mumps had at least one, many of them two, MMR vaccines, so they should have been protected from getting the mumps. In the pertussis outbreaks that were happening in California, we found that out that the vast majority of those children had had pertussis vaccination and had the full series. We know that in the military that there are people that have been fully vaccinated and there have been outbreaks of rubella and measles. So we also know from the medical literature that even people who've been fully vaccinated against tetanus, that have had four or more tetanus shots and have antibodies levels, which would be defined by the medical literature as being protective antibody levels, still contracted full-blown tetanus, which then tells us that having an antibody doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be protected from getting the illness for which you've been vaccinated against. We use the words immunization and vaccination as though they were synonyms. They are not. Vaccination, by definition, is the act of giving a shot. And that is what vaccination really means. Immunization means that you have become immune. You do not necessarily become immune from a vaccine. In fact, there's a large body of evidence that shows that it only causes harm. It really doesn't make you immune at all. So the definition of immunity means that you have had a natural infection from a community-acquired virus or bacterial infection, but primarily viruses. And the difference being is that vaccination engages mainly one part of your immune system, which is called the Th2 side of the immune system, and it primarily engages that arm. That's why over time, when you have an antibody, it goes away. And that's why even those who believe in vaccines know that the antibodies wane and why they are promoting now many, many, many booster shots. We know that when you have a community-acquired infection, such as measles or mumps or rubella or even influenza or chickenpox, it engages both sides of the immune system, the side that's called Th2, which creates the antibodies, the Th1 side of the equation, which engages the self-immunity that is defined by the difference between knowing who you are and where your environment stops. And those two types of the immune system go through this really nice dance when you have a real infection and you have fever and you have cytokines and you have white blood cells and you have all of these different types of portions of your immune system coming together in a dance. And that's where lifetime true immunity comes from. When you are re-exposed to a virus or re-exposed to that infection, your immune system has been fully engaged and recognizes that and says, I don't have to process that again. We've done that once. They push out a little bit of intrinsic immune system help to push that virus out of the way, and that's where true immunity comes from. When babies are born, they are by definition born immature. Their neurological system is immature, their immune system is immature, their lungs have to take that first deep breath in order to get surfactant and mature their lungs. So from the moment of birth and that first deep breath, there are an enormous number of cascades that have to happen in order for all of the systems to be go and to click on all of the buttons. It's like launching the space shuttle off of the pad. All of the systems have to be go. And all of these cytokines and all of these hormones and everything starts processing all at the same time. What we do to these newborns is within minutes of birth, they're exposed to latex. They're exposed to vitamin K shots, a vitamin K shot that is given almost immediately after birth, on the outside chance that a very rare blood disorder might be happening in this baby. It has 9 milligrams of benzyl alcohol, and there have been reports in the pediatric literature, particularly the Canadian pediatric literature, that thinks that it's that vitamin K shot that's given right at birth that leads these children, many of them, down the pathway into jaundice, and they have kernicterus and all these different problems because their liver is not meant to handle that big dose of alcohol as soon as they're born. Within a few more hours after birth, then we give them a hepatitis B vaccine. The first paper that came out about the hepatitis B vaccine and using that vaccine in America was based off of a study that was done in Southeast Asia, where 10% of the population of women in Southeast Asia are endemic to carrying the hepatitis B virus. That 1991 paper, in essence, said, because hepatitis B is endemic in the population in Southeast Asia, and mothers there have high incidence of hepatitis B, we should probably give the hepatitis B vaccine to children in this country. It made no sense to me then. It probably makes no sense now. And so within hours, we have assaulted this brand new being that's just landed on this planet with all these systems meaning to go, and we've hit them with antibiotics in their eyes. Many times they're exposed to antibiotics coming through the birth canal. If mom has a strep B infection, they get a vitamin K shot, they get a hepatitis B vaccine, they get an exposure to latex, and now they're maybe 6 hours old. A mere 8 weeks old, 8 weeks old, 56 days of life on this planet, the baby goes in for its first well baby checkup. And at that time, they may be given up to 6 or 7 different vaccines, a DPT, which is diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, a polio vaccine, another hepatitis B vaccine, a Hib, which is for Haemophilus influenza B, and possibly a Prevnar vaccine, which is 7 strains of strep, maybe even 13 strains of strep, all given at the same time. So it's like giving 20 or 30 vaccine antigens in about 5 or 6 shots. Each of those shots.
That was Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, a board-certified physician who was pro-vaccine till she spent over 15,000 hours of scholarly research, and it really awakened her to the reality of the safety and efficacy of vaccines. We'll continue tomorrow with part 2 of her discussion. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.